Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. This is James Corbett, CorbettReport.com. This is another edition of the Geneva Business Insider with our old friend David L. Smith of GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. You should know the drill by now, where we talk to David Smith about everything that's happening around the world, geopolitically, socially, and otherwise. So it's great to have you here once again, David. Thank you for joining us.
Good to be back after the summer break.
Absolutely. Well, I hope you're having a good summer there in Switzerland, but it is not a good summer for everyone. And I actually want to start out today by talking about an interesting story. I don't think it's particularly surprising, but I think it's interesting nonetheless. Talking about the bankruptcy of what was once one of the largest and most economically powerful cities in America, which is almost laughable to think about in this day and age. But we're talking about the death of the American dream in the Motor City of Detroit and Detroit's bankruptcy, which is a pretty remarkable thing, but perhaps not so remarkable, again, given all of the surrounding circumstances. From your perspective there in Europe, watching the European collapse, what do you make of this latest collapse in the United States?
Well, I think the collapse in Detroit, much to my regret, is an inevitable consequence of the process of outsourcing and globalization. The companies that used to make the economy there, and notably General Motors and the Ford and Chrysler, were very powerful economies. But if you look at where they actually manufacture things now, I mean, the manufacturing's done in completely different places. What did remain in Detroit is a collapsing city with the most dreadful crime rates imaginable. And I can tell you, you know, I went to Detroit in the 1970s, because at the time I used to work for a company called Burroughs Machines, which also was headquartered in Detroit. And I was thrilled to go there and see this, bastion of American capitalism turning over at full speed. But if the statistics are right, I mean, I think the employees in the industrial sector in Detroit are down to around 20% of what they were at their peak. Certainly, the computer industry has moved out of there as well, and all you have is an inner city collapse with increasing drugs, increasing crime, decreasing revenues, and the whole thing has been predictable for the last 20 years. And if we look back to the start of the Obama, let's call it regime, when he went to Detroit to rescue the city, I mean, he was basically rescuing the unions and their pension plans because the city was already unsavable. And now all you're doing is looking at the consequences of not facing up to a problem which could have been faced up to 5 years ago. And if you take as well those people who do remain in the manufacturing business in motor cars in America, you come up with Toyota, Honda, and so on, who manufacture and whose labor costs are half of those of the unionized workers in the city of Detroit. Additionally, as well, one of the companies in Geneva, SGS, were one of the main shareholders, were the Agnelli family of Fiat. They have now sold off their investments in SGS here for several billion, and they're reinvesting in the motor vehicle industry. And I suspect that reinvestment is just to stave off collapse, because the cash requirements from these companies are so colossal. However, I mean, if you look at the top end of the scale, there are some people, distinguished people, who made great careers out of the motor industry, who have hundreds of millions in the bank, and who fly around in their private airplanes and have a nice life. And of course, the worker at the bottom end of the scale is just dumped. So this is globalization. It is a perfect example of the decay that is being manufactured for America systematically. It's planned that way. There's no question about it. And I'm afraid Mr. Obama is nothing more than complicit in engineering the decline of America and doing it with speeches which completely misrepresent to the people what is actually happening.
Well, I have no doubt that the crony capitalists at the top of the major motor companies will not be exactly hurting for trying to make the rent payment at the end of the month, unlike the workers that they've left at the bottom of that pile, as you point out. But at any rate, this will give us the chance to see how the bankruptcy of a city, a municipality of the size of Detroit, will unfold technically and legally and everything, which is perhaps a grim spectacle to behold, but a spectacle nonetheless. And of course, bringing it back to the European context, how does this compare to the possibility of the default of a country that we're seeing, for example, in Greece?
Well, before leaving the US, I would mention Chicago, which has teed itself up to end it exactly the same tragic way as Detroit. It's the same problems are there, same structural problems. If we go to Greece, Greece was manufactured rather differently because instead of having its manufacturing capacity stripped out of it by globalization, what they had was money injected into it that should never have been injected into it by globalist banks, who basically gave people who should never have had the money in the first place loans in order to go and buy BMWs and washing machines and, you know, build second homes, etc. So the same class of people are responsible, but the method is rather different. And of course, the story of Greece, you know, is so well publicized by now. I don't think anything's going to happen in Greece until at least the German elections are over, because whatever bribe is necessary to pay to keep people quiet will be paid. But after that, we're seeing some very interesting developments, I think, in Greece. Notably, the arrival of the Chinese on a fairly big scale. They bought a number of years ago the port of Piraeus, and I had lunch yesterday with a Greek friend who'd just come back from there. And Piraeus is now one of the most competitive ports in the world because it's run by people who know how to run big ports. And I see that the Chinese are looking at buying the Greek railway system. They're looking at buying the second closed airport outside Athens, the old international airport, and no doubt renovating that into a major cargo hub. And from the Chinese point of view, this is a perfect entry into Europe. Okay, it's a bit of a long drive, but they're there. They can do the same kind of deal as is done in Dubai with a duty-free area. And hey presto, one step closer to Chinesization, whatever you want to call it. Now, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but I think it's just a tragic that a sovereign nation has allowed itself through its corrupt politicians and corrupt global banking external influences to slide into this situation. And ironically, for once, I think what is happening in Greece is exactly the opposite outcome of that which the globalist banks would have wanted, because they have got the arrival of a global superpower stamping on their backyard. So I don't know how it'll all end up, but interesting times.
Interesting indeed, and it certainly does boggle the mind and also, of course, infuriate those who have eyes to see what's happening there, as the infrastructure that has been paid for by the on the back of the Greek taxpayers is now being sold off at pennies on the dollar to foreign investors in China and the like. So it is a horrific situation, and it's one that we see playing out in increasingly across the Western world, as we see this systemic collapse that's coming about, as you point out, I think, from the process of globalization, which has been steered and directed by the multinationals and the governments in their back pockets for so long now. Another aspect of what's happening right now, if we bring it back to the U.S. context for a moment, we see that as the QE taperings is at least promised to begin later this year, or perhaps it's going to begin later this year, we see, of course, the bond yield spiking, and that means that people are starting the so-called rotation out of bonds and into equities and, of course, housing, because why not? It's worked out so well in the past decade. Why not try it again this decade? So we hear a lot of talk about this housing recovery that's supposedly starting in the U.S. Once again, and we even have President Obama attempting to pump and hype up the housing recovery in the United States. Give us your own perspective about this so-called recovery and what's really happening here.
Well, I mean, the housing recovery is once again a false recovery, and Obama is doing nothing more for the housing sector and the NRA. The acronym escapes me for a moment, National Association of Realtors. He's basically doing the same propaganda pitch for them as he's doing in the motor industry. And why shouldn't he? Because the NER is one of the major contributors to the Democrats' election campaign. And always has been. So I do not believe that there is any genuine recovery in the sector. What has happened is that there has been hedge funds diving into very attractive areas, buying up property and pushing up the prices. But it's a pump and dump game. And of course, the general public doesn't actually realize this. They see all the big names going in. But then you see companies that are meant to be doing this kind of business trying to float the shares on the market, and the price falls over 40% within even before the shares are actually issued. So the smart money is bailing out, the dumb money is coming in, and this is the way America functions. You know, the only reason there was a subprime problem is because the banks who had those debts on their books, or the institutions that had those debts on their books, said, we know this is all going to blow up, we've got to get out. So what mechanism do we create to get out of it? Then we have collateral mortgage-backed securities, and hey presto, dump it onto the market, into some unsuspecting pension fund, and move on. So this is where the housing market is going. What is very interesting is that the bond yields are currently rising quite substantially. And that means that financing costs are rising substantially. And the little guy who's going to be buying into this wonderful reblown bubble is setting himself up for the housing market to perform a bit like a bond when the yield goes up, which means that, you know, the price goes down. So it all just looks so familiar. Same old, same old. And I just wish people would stop falling for the game. And I wish the politicians, and especially a president who's meant to look after the interests of the country, would stop pumping this kind of rubbish to his citizens.
It is head-scratching why the public continues to fall for these games time and time and time again, but unfortunately they do, and this really does tend to drive those markets and make this disaster seem to come in a cyclical way every several years. They need to pump up another bubble and blow it up and move on to the next one, and unfortunately that looks exactly like what's happening right now. And as you point out, long-term treasury yields are spiking. They've already gone from 1.5% to 2.5%, and this is only at the suggestion that the QE tapering is going to begin. What's your sense on their ability to contain bond yields once QE tapering really does begin, or even if it doesn't, maybe they've backed themselves into a corner and they have to continue this infinitely?
Well, to me, I think the situation is an irreversible situation. I saw Bill Gross from PIMCO observed rather wisely the other day. He says, you know, everyone agrees that after QE 1, 2, and 3, the stock market has gone up very substantially. So if you reverse QE 1, 2, and 3, what's going to happen? And bonds are a bit the same thing. I mean, there's a comment from Andrew Sentance, who used to be on the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, who said, people have to realize we deliberately blown the biggest bond bubble in history. Now, there's a man who is more honest than the others, and obviously he's no longer a member of the committee, probably for exactly that reason. So what we're sitting and looking at the moment is I just hear a little sound going tick, 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 tick. And at some point it's going to blow. And I see absolutely... I mean, you can talk about tapering and you can try it, but just even talking about it was enough to throw the market into a panic. So if you actually do it, my goodness me, what's going to happen? And there's an awful lot of tapering to be done. I mean, it's you're talking about $80 billion a month. So if they drop it to 60 and they find the market falls out of bed, well, that would be interesting. So it simply means that instead of a trillion being thrown into a hole in the ground, it becomes down to $700 billion. And the idea of actually turning the taps off and facing reality will never happen. And to me, I mean, the whole situation is rather like, you know, a guy who's got terminal cancer, and at the same time he's got an insulin problem. And you're treating the cancer pain with morphine and the insulin with sugar. But you realize that this, and those things are a bit like QE and interest rates. But if you remove the one or the other, there's either going to be rapid death or terrible pain or both. So, you know, if you actually put yourself in the situation of people like the Bernankes of this world or the Obamas of this world, it's very easy to understand why they don't actually want to face the problem, and they just keep the guy on the happy pills and the treatment, knowing that there is no way out, there is no salvation, but the problem doesn't come today.
Well, as someone who's been observing and commenting on this now for years, it certainly, to my own mind, it really does seem like there's a certain inevitability about all of this. And as you point out, I mean, I think the terminal cancer analogy is one that's been used before and will probably be used again because it seems particularly apt. There is a cancer in the economy that is not being cut out. It's being merely masked over by these central bank actions, but that can only work for so long. So we do know that this bubble has been inflated. We do know it's going to pop. We do know there's going to be a lot of carnage in the markets and in people's lives, more importantly, as that starts to unfold. I guess the real question is not merely what can we observe about the way this is going to happen or how soon it will happen or things of that nature, but what will survive in the aftermath? What are people doing that might be a positive sign for the future of what ways that people can escape this? Is there anything that you see on the table right now for a serious proposal for some sort of alternative infrastructure that might survive this type of collapse?
Well, the answer is no, because even if there were, it would mean an admission that there was a problem. Now, those who are in power are in denial publicly and probably in large part in denial privately. And the people who should be able to do something to correct the situation and who understand the situation, you know, like people who run banks or whatever, or the institutions which are meant to provide some kind of stability to our society, they are maybe not in denial, but they are muzzled because they're part of the ruling elite. So they cannot, you know, if you're running the FDIC, which is meant to bail out banks, you can't stand up and say, well, look, I got $20 billion in money to bail out the banks, but the problem is somewhere between $200 billion and $2 trillion, because you'd be quietly asked to leave your position or decried as a lunatic. It's the same thing with the ISDA, the swaps and derivatives organization, which decides if there's been a default on bonds or things like that. Once again, these people aren't going to stand up and say this is, you know, this we have actually defaulted, the Greeks have defaulted, all the manipulations we're doing amounts to, QE buying bonds at unrealistic prices is, to my mind, a form of default, but nobody actually says it. You know, the legal system, it's the same thing. It's either muzzled or neutered. So you go through all of the institutions which should actually ring alarm bells and provide some kind of counterbalance to government mythology, including the mainstream media, and you realize that they're all muzzled, complicit, dumbed down to a point where they're not going to say anything, and they don't want to be the first ones to step out of line, because the one who does step out of line is going to take a big hit. And if anyone actually gets even slightly tempted to, you'll probably find they get a visit from the NSA saying, hold on, you know, we got the negatives and the tape recordings. So I think it will go on for a long time. What I have tried to do, and from my own interest, is to say, you know, to a few people I know who are reasonably well placed, well, why not try and model what's going to happen? Now, I mean, the very simple part of it is to say, all right, well, guns, gold, and a getaway plan, that's all very true. But that doesn't solve the problem for, you know, 10 million people living in the urban area of New York. It just simply is not going to be an option for them. So you can do these kind of things and make sure you've got a stock of food, make sure you've got security, etc. But that addresses in no way what the future business model has to be. Now, I do believe that behind the scenes that there are some very powerful people who are already investing a lot of money in working out what that model is going to be and how best to introduce it and when to introduce it and how much pain the general public has to face before it happens. And if you look at the legislation that's been put in place in America over the last 12 or 24 months, you will see that they're preparing for things like bail-ins, they're preparing for taking money out of pension plans, they're preparing to use the army against the civil population in terms of severe unrest. All of that is preparatory and visible because they have to put the legislation into place. But, they don't have to. I mean, they could do it like Stalin and just do it by sheer terror. But, once a few drones have flown over Fifth Avenue and shot a few people, I think there'll be a lot of people stay inside who would otherwise have been in the street objecting to what was going on. So all of this is work in progress for the elites, and I just do not see any coherent way forward for the moment, and certainly nothing will be said about it until the collapse has taken place, and there's a great deal of pain, and whatever proposal will be made at a time when people are just only so happy to accept any proposal that comes along to get out of the agonies that they're suffering.
Well, I think it's unfortunately all too apparent that that's exactly what we're being set up for. And of course, no one in the mainstream or any of the officially sanctioned agencies or institutions are going to be speaking out against this ahead of time. But I think that means that they're really the only two options for us are either to simply go along with whatever they end up proposing when the collapse finally comes, or to begin the setting up of an alternative citizens-based financial infrastructure, which, I mean, is an mind-bogglingly overwhelming activity to even think about how that would unfold. But do you believe that we are now at the point where there is at least the technological capability to set up some sort of viable alternative structure with cryptocurrencies and credit unions and the like being able to at least supplement some of what's happening right now in terms of the international finance community?
Oh, no, I don't think there's any possibility of that. I mean, the infrastructures that are in place are, I mean, it's taken 100 years to put them in place. You know, the international bank payment system, SWIFT, all these kind of things. And they're under the control of the very same people who are the origin of the problem. So I don't see that as being a solution. The Bitcoin solution or being able to move on to a kind of a barter system between people who have actually organized in advance, I think that is a reasonably realistic thing to imagine. But you could never, ever, without the cooperation of the international institutions, you could never mount a coherent version of doing business. It's just not possible. However, I think on the other hand, the whole system can't work without the consent of the people, at least to some degree. And you can see that in Greece when they go on strike for a few days, or the GDP takes another turn downwards, or there are riots in the street and so on. You know, once again, the elites can't maintain control in circumstances like that. And I think, unfortunately, we will have to pass by that phase at some point, to some degree, everywhere. And I'm certainly not looking forward to it. But I think that's the inevitability of not addressing the problem of a collapsing system. I mean, it's a financial Fukushima, if you like.
Well put. But that leaves us in a very sticky situation where it seems like the collapse is going to come and there's basically very little you can do about it. And eventually you'll just have to take up guns and try to fight the government? And what would that even serve if we don't have a game plan of what to do? I mean, I think there has to be some sort of plan that we should be working towards, but who is articulating that and where is it going to come from? That's perhaps a bigger question than our pay grades would allow us to answer, but something that, again, needs to be desperately talked about, which is why I'm constantly talking about some of these ideas like cryptocurrencies and alternative currencies and the like. But as you say, it doesn't it isn't able to really replace the system that we've been put onto over the past century, at least, of increasing internationalization. Some very, very big topics today. I'm not sure where you'd like to take it from there. Is there anything else you'd like to address today before we wind things up?
We talked about, I mentioned Fukushima. I mean, that seems to be coming back into the headlines. And in a way, it is an exact reflection of all that is wrong with the world that we have at the moment. You know, you have a company like TEPCO, which is a major institution. You know it much better locally than I do, obviously. You know, who clearly done an absolutely diabolical job. They've had the government cover up for them. I mean, it's like General Motors all over again. It's just, instead of blowing up a town, they've blown up a plant. And 3 years later, is it 3 years now, we're talking about Mr. Abe getting involved in trying to theoretically do something to wave a magic wand. Well, you know, a magic wand should have been waved 3 years ago and people should have faced up to the problems. And I've been at presentations from people in the nuclear industry, Lady Judge, for example, who's head of the nuclear industry in the UK, where she basically said everything was tickety-boo and hunky-dory and Fukushima and it was all under control. Now, I mean, these people have no problem going on platforms and lying because that's what they're paid for. And, you know, I did ask her one difficult question about the dangers of Fukushima, and it was just kind of brushed off as though it was a non-question, although she did thank me for the question after the lunch, and I said, well, it would be nice if you'd answered it. So, I mean, here we have something that could have a major effect on the world, and no one's talked about it for 3 years. And who knows what level of toxicity is going to get into the food chain. One thing I do know is no one's going to talk about it, no one's going to report on it, and there's going to be people start having cancerous problems from eating fish out of their local supermarket. The direct cause of it will have been something that happened several years ago in a place called Fukushima. But the political class have no shame, they have no integrity, they conspire with the major economic influences, the mainstream media is in bed with them, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Japan or America or the UK or Germany or France, it's the same story everywhere. And the only cure for it is for the citizens to wake up and revolt. Because these guys are not going to stop telling lies and feeding you, radioactive fish and until you make them stop. Very sad, but I just think that's the way it is.
Well, at the very least, people need to find a way to get off of their electrical grid as much as humanly possible and stop feeding the TEPCO beast that is very much at the heart of this. And the Japanese government can attempt to defray their own responsibility in terms of what's gone on, but it's just a fact that the Japanese government have become the largest stakeholder in TEPCO since they bailed them out. So it is a situation that has been festering for years, and now it's finally coming to mainstream attention for whatever reason at this point in time. But unfortunately, that will probably not result in anything a positive unless the people press it. So again, I hope people are aware of this issue, and I hope the people of Japan will start being a little bit more formidable in terms of their opposition to this, as opposed to what we've seen so far. But I'm not exactly holding my breath for that. Again,
if I just make one comment, James, you know, the people of Japan are responsible for poisoning of the food chain of the world. And if they don't stand up, I mean, who can stand up and do anything about it? When it's not them necessarily who's going to be eating the fish. You know, if you watch the currents going across the Atlantic, it may well be people in Malibu who are eating the fish that are completely radioactive. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, no problem. I agree. The buck has to stop somewhere, and it has to be done sooner rather than later. It's already been happening for 2.5 years.
Yeah.
All right. Well, not a particularly happy conversation today, but unfortunately, such is the state of the world. Anything else you'd like to say before we leave?
No, I think the world will go on very well, but people have to wake up to their responsibilities. Nothing that has ever happened in the past has been obtained by without fighting for it. And the trouble is, we've had 50 years where people haven't had to fight for it. And you can see how quickly things go off the rails. And Reagan did say, you know, we're one generation away from anarchy, away from losing our freedom. And we have the positive proof, because that's exactly the world that we're living in right now. So people can turn this around. They have to turn it around. And if they don't, the future is very very grim. But I'm pretty optimistic, because people always do the right thing, even if it's at the very last minute.
Well, I am.
I just did my tax returns. It's a very good example of doing the right thing at the last minute.
On that note, I am personally optimistic that we will achieve anarchy in one generation. If only, I would be happy if we could. at any rate, we'll leave it there for now. Once again, David L. Smith, GenevaBusinessInsider.blogspot.com. Of course, I'll put the link in the show notes for people who are interested in checking out your work there and, of course, your other services. So we'll leave it there for now. David Smith, thank you again for your time.
Pleasure to be on the show once again. Thanks a lot.